Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us today for this panel event. My name's Meriden Varal. I'm the director of the East Asia program here at the Lowy Institute. Before we go any further, I would just like to acknowledge that this event is being held on the traditional land of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation, and I'd like to pay respects to their elders past and present, and of course any Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander peoples who are here with us today. So today we have our third and final event in our China AMP series. We've had already a fabulous discussion of China's demography and the demographic challenges it's facing. We've talked about China and the global order, and today we're talking about Xi's new era and what it means. And I'm joined by two eminent experts in these areas. I'm very delighted to have Professor Anne-Marie Brady over from New Zealand to be with us today. You may have seen Anne-Marie's full bio on the website, but to summarise, Anne-Marie is a professor in the Department of Political Science at the University of Canterbury, Christchurch. She's also a global fellow at the Woodrow Wilson Centre in Washington, D.C., and non-resident senior fellow at the China Policy Institute at the University of Nottingham. What an international life. Professor Brady is a fluent Mandarin speaker and expert in Chinese polar politics, and has written extensively on a range of issues, including this polar politics, as well as China's modern propaganda system, New Zealand-China relations, New Zealand foreign policy, and the idea of foreigner management in China, which we might get to in more detail today. I'm also joined by non-resident Lowy Institute fellow Peter Tsai. Peter was a journalist with The Australian, with Business Spectator, The Age and the Sydney Morning Herald. He covered business and economic news. Before his glorious career in journalism, Peter was at the Australian Treasury, even more glorious, where he worked in the Foreign Investment Review Board Secretariat, focusing largely on state-owned enterprises and sovereign wealth fund investment policy. So to just give you a little bit of context, we know that in China's recent 19th Party Congress, the Chinese Communist Party General Secretary Xi Jinping announced that it was time for a new era of socialism with Chinese characteristics, which this idea has now been enshrined in the party constitution as Xi Jinping thought. And today we're going to talk about what this new era actually means in practice, and we'll focus on a few different policy areas and discuss what they mean both for China but also internationally. Now, when Xi came to power in 2007, some analysts and commentators thought, or perhaps desperately hoped was a better word, that he would be a reformer in the kind of Western sense of the word. When he demonstrated his commitment to putting the party first above all else, they concluded that this might have been a little bit of turning left to turn right, that is, shoring up his support before he moved into kind of real reforms. But I think Xi's speech at the 19th Party Congress, 3.5 inspirational hours, put these illusions to rest once and for all. Xi's made it absolutely clear that his ambitions for China will be achieved not in spite of or around the edges of, but firmly thanks to the Chinese Communist Party. So this is the kind of the backdrop, the context to this question of the new era of socialism with Chinese characteristics. So I want to get started by asking our panelists about what they see as the key elements of Xi's new era. Maybe pick two or three points each that you think are the really critical components. And if I can start with you, Anne-Marie.
Thanks very much, and kia ora, everybody. I was in China for a month during the time of the 19th Party Congress, and I was really struck by the atmosphere there. Of, you know, on the outside, we're really, you know, there's a lot of media attention on China that's very critical of Xi Jinping and what the government's doing there. But in Shanghai, I was really amazed at the message that I heard from people there, actually, that they were reasonably happy with the way things are going. And that was people, whether they're residents of Shanghai or outsiders who are on temporary residency. So I think that's something that when we look at China, we have to think about what Chinese people think about it all as well. And Chinese people are pretty realistic about their politics. So, but that doesn't mean to say that we shouldn't be critical about what's going on, because often, I mean, more than definitely, we can say things that cannot be said in China. So I think there's both the kind of ways in which Chinese people measure the changes, and the way their level of realism about their ability to change them, and then their ability to speak out about them as well. So that's my preface to my observations of how things are. And I was really struck by that mood that I found in Shanghai, because at other times that I've been in China, people have been more critical. I think people were kind of resigned in a way to and accept and recognizing that it's a real affirmation of the solidity of Xi Jinping's power base, that people are sort of understand that this is it for the long run. So that's my first response to you about a change that I notice.
Okay, thank you. Peter, what do you think, maybe some of the key elements there?
I think maybe just let me concentrate on the economic aspect. I still remember, so when Xi Jinping was first appointed during his first term as the Secretary General of the party, he unveiled this very comprehensive economic reform agenda. I think it's my last job at Fairfax, so I actually wrote a news report as well as a commentary on it. I think at the time, a lot of people were really excited by the language that the market will be allowed to play a very decisive role in allocating resource and transforming the economy. I think that kind of really galvanized a lot of the people really around the prospect of economic or further economic reform in China. I think now he finished his first term. It's I can pass my own subjective assessment on, you know, what I thought would be the pace of economic reform, but I think being a kind of economic analyst, I perhaps prefer give it a bit of more quantitative vigor. So China has a really good publication, business economic publication called Caixin. So we actually construct a reform tracking matrix. So you look at 113 areas of economic reform in China, not political or social, but economic reform agenda. So they basically want to track the kind of economic reform in China for the last 4 or 5 years. So out of 113 areas, 23 areas are regarded as progressing really well, so-called the fast land of economic reform. And in 16 areas, basically in stopping land, so nothing happened, too hard basket. Then in 84 areas, it's pretty much in a slow-moving land. So in that way, we can say that perhaps out of 100 policy areas that need attention and economic reform, about 20% of them is going well. Then you can form your own judgment about whether the economic reform actually is happening in China. But I think later on, I'm probably going to give you some examples of things that actually happened, are pretty positive, and the things that aren't happening. But I just want to give you a little bit of a kind of an introduction, just based on some really good work by Caixin.
So it would be great if we could get from you guys just a couple of maybe specific examples of some of these reforms that we've sort of sketched out the context a little bit. Some of the specific reforms in your areas of expertise that you think Xi Jinping's or policy shifts that Xi Jinping has brought in as part of this new era that you think are particularly important for us to think about.
Terminology. So it's the end of talk of reform and opening up. We're in the new era, so that's important to note. And there are some other new technology is that China is going to be a tiangguo, a great power on a whole lot of areas. So when I was listening to Xi's 3.5-hour speech and the many other speeches during the Congress, I had a really weird sense of deja vu, because what was being described is stuff that in this book, actually, I brought it along because I thought it was relevant to our discussions. This is my new book, China is a Polar Great Power. So China's intentions have actually been made really clear, if you can read the Chinese sources, about its global ambitions. So I would say it's not that what Xi is doing is new, it's that it's being announced to the outside world now. So if you can read the Chinese materials as I have been, China has, Xi actually announced in Hobart in 2014 that China was aspiring to be a polar great power, and the Australian media didn't pick up on that. But China has a long-term foreign policy agenda. And we saw an adjustment in that foreign policy strategy from about 2008 onwards, where China was going to began to be more assertive and speaking up, facing up to challenges that that it felt that was being challenged on its national interests. Well, under Xi Jinping, we've had now for 3 years or so the be proactive strategy. And it was this year, it's really escalated China's level of assertion in policy. And I think that's really a factor of the changing global environment, particularly the behaviour of the US government and a vacuum of power that's appearing. And so we saw Xi making strong statements in January and in February about China willing to take on a leadership role. And that was reiterated at the Congress. But I wouldn't want to emphasize this as being new so much as part of a trajectory. And as you mentioned, another important part of policy that's come out, that's been highlighted during the 19th Party Congress, but which has been foreshadowed in the last 5 years, is the re-strengthening of the role of the CCP in Chinese society. And from my research of China's modernized propaganda system, I can tell you that the concern about how the CCP was losing contact with its party members, and it was the party had what they call blind spots over the in its inability to communicate with the Chinese population, has been a concern since the 1990s, and it's all about the economic reform policies by dismantling the state-owned enterprises and all the other big transformations in Chinese society. At the same time, the party cell structure was in society was dismantled, and Chinese society was on the move too. People moved out of the countryside into the cities, and they were living in they had temporary permits. So how does they, and they don't have a TV or all the normal ways that the channels that the party would have communicated with them had disappeared. So the Congress was significant as sort of announcing something that has already been a concern, and then the policies to deal with have been underway for a long time. And then last point I want to make is about the very strict controls on propaganda, ideology, at civil society and ethnic minorities, which again is a trend that's been going on for a while. But it really, the real high tide of it was throughout the 19th Party Congress and in the weeks after, when there were group meetings all around the country to study Xi Jinping's thought. And in fact, during that 3.5-hour speech in universities and other government institutions, people had to sit down and listen to that speech. So political study sessions are back in. And boy, that's a really big change. Back to the future. If you're a Uyghur or a Tibetan, the tight controls over their communities have been very strict since 2008. I wouldn't have thought they could have got stricter, but they have under Xi, but that's a trend. And the information environment, controls over propaganda and ideology, they've been tightening ever since 2012.
Thanks. Maybe later we could come back to talk a little bit about some of those particular tightening examples, like with the civil society and with ideology, if we can come back to that later. But Peter, what about some specific examples from your point of view?
I think, as I alluded to earlier on, about the pace of economic reform during the first term of Xi, I think it's quite useful. I think to go back a little bit, look at the history of economic reform in China, I think they kind of set a bit of a benchmark. I think in a way we can draw a parallel analogy of what actually happened here in Australia and also in China. I think we had a really good 1980s, 90s, a lot of reforms and et cetera. Then kind of last big item kind of reform, economic reform agenda at least we had was the broad-based, GST, consumption tax. But in China, it's a very similar trajectory. 1980s were just really the heady times for economic reform. The planned economy was in a way dismantled. Then the Tiananmen massacre set it back. But in the 1990s and early 2000s, once again, the China's economic reform picked up, especially under the premiership of Zhu Rongji. China joined the WTO, quite a transformative event. But now the economic reform really kind of slowed down significantly. Let me just give you one example. One of the most difficult areas to tackle in China is around the state-owned enterprises. Remember that before 1978, there was no private business to speak of. But after the reform, like the private business in China really blossomed and it became a very important pillar of the economy in terms of employment, tax revenue, and etc. But you still got in a very large, inefficient state sector. In the 1990s, especially around after the Asian financial crisis, at a time, a very reformist premier, Zhu Rongji, was really a great economic reformer. So he dealt the problem with the inefficient state sector. He closed down thousands of factories, laid off about 21 million people in the state-owned sector, and cut down the state-owned sector productivity's production capacity by about 20%, really enabled the private sector to grow in China. But now, if you look at the state-owned enterprises, it just literally become once again this really true hard basket. Now, when we talk about the state-owned enterprises reform, it's now about privatization. It's not even about a partial privatization. It is about making them more competitive, actually about merger them together, create some big behemoths so they can become national champions. I just think this is a very clear and interesting area where there's kind of a sharp contrast between what CCP did before. And also, during the Zhu Rongji's time, the foreign banks were allowed to purchase quite a significant minority stake in large Chinese banks, 20% by HSBC, big banks. But now, it's hardly conceivable that this kind of things were allowed to happen, especially with the big banks in the financial service sector. I just think that's a big contrast. And as I mentioned before, things are kind of happening on much a smaller scale in terms of economic reform, but doesn't mean that things are not happening. I think it's important to give some credit, especially to the people in the China's kind of the financial service regulator, especially to the central bank, which is in the kind of landscape of bleakness, is actually really good, because there were two things. Last year, especially 2015, it actually introduced the market-based exchange rate. It caused a lot of volatility because at the time people thought the Chinese government tried to devalue the currency. But I think it was a genuine reform to make the exchange rate more flexible. But the mayhem it caused in the international market really made them rethink about the pace and the speed in which they want to introduce reform. And also they liberalized the interest rate, which is quite significant, because for a very long time, the model in China is really based on this really squeezed interest rate, squeeze as much as possible out of a depositor so they can be transformed into the heavy industries and et cetera that need capital investment. That was liberalized. I think it's quite significant, because now you see Chinese banks branching to all the different areas because that guaranteed margin disappeared. So there are some reform, but unfortunately, it's only led by, one or two good reformers institution. And also we're seeing the dying out, not literally, but they are fading into retirement. The generation of a really good Chinese economic reformers from the 1980s, the central bank governor, the former finance minister, Lu Jiwei, and, Wang Qishan, and all these people are kind of fading into retirement. I think, in a way, that's kind of a bad news for China's economic reform. So a very powerful group of reformers are kind of leaving the stage.
No one, you think, who's in the wings waiting to come in?
Not anyone I can think of off the top of my head, but yeah.
So that implies a certain trajectory then in the future, then, if there's not an obvious group. So what I think I'm picking up then is that, from Anne-Marie, what you're saying, we're seeing it's what Xi Jinping has announced, or what he was talking about in the 19th Party Congress, is not anything particularly new and radical. It's a trajectory that was started under, at least in his first term, and if not under Hu Jintao before him, and that's this ideological tightening, political tightening, these kind of reforms. And at the same time, we're seeing that economic reform is also slowing or changing in shape, that there's less political will for real economic reform. Is that a fair picture?
Yeah, I see a lot of continuity in the policies. And I always, when I think about China and change occurring in China, I always have in my mind this a ginormous container ship and how very hard it is to go in another direction, that they move very slowly. So that means that we can, if we're paying attention to the Chinese policy documents, that we can observe their general direction. And of course, they do respond. They have some, like every government, they have to respond to crises, and that may require an obstacle. The North Korean situation might be one of those obstacles. But I think there is a lot of continuity. But in some of the policies that I'm interested in, I would definitely say that this year we've seen a turning up the volume, and we've seen the turning up the volume when it comes to foreign policy. We've seen a turning up the volume on a topic that I've been writing on this year, and that is about China's united front work, and that's connected in to a more assertive foreign policy. And when it comes to the controls over the information environment, and the party's relationship with party members and the role of the party in society, I think the big difference with Xi Jinping and between Xi Jinping and Hu Jintao and Jiang Zemin is that Xi Jinping has a lot more power than the other two leaders had. He was advantaged in that his main rival for power, Bo Xilai, was knocked out of power before the 18th Party Congress. And also the flow-on effects of that was that the leadership of at the most senior level of the party were willing to accept more concentrated powers than the party has seen since the Mao era. And then you have to add in Xi's own personality as well, who he's obviously a very forceful personality and is making the most of the opportunity he's been given. So I'd say that's the main difference there, is those circumstances and the individual personality and then the changing global order. But in terms of the policies, there's a lot of consistency and continuity in general.
Give us a couple of specific examples in, say, areas of civil society or ideology or the areas that you particularly work on of how that volume has been turned up.
Well, you know, look at the constraints on public speech, on social media. I mean, Weibo was a really huge phenomena in China until 2012, and then just the volume turned right down on that one. And and universities have been under pressure, and that's just going on and on. I mean, and there was some resistance when it first efforts began in 2013, and a lot of academics speaking out and rejecting what was the then Minister of Education made some statements that were very unpopular. But I think that now my observation from being in China in October, November is a sort of a resigned acceptance that this is the phase that China is in at the moment. And Richard Baum, who was a great political scientist of China at UCLA, sadly passed away in 2012. And others like Susan Shirk have talked about the how China goes through these cycles of opening and closing. And but the thing is, usually we could expect that they were quite short, the closing cycles. But when you ask people in China, when do you think this strict controls of the Xi era will change? What's, you know, the Xin Tang Tai, the new normal? People that I talk to who are real party insiders say never. And so there's a kind of a pessimism that I haven't seen before in China. That's why I meant right at the beginning about the realism that there is in China about their political system and people's ability to do anything really about it.
Yeah. And Peter, what about in terms of the, you know, you mentioned earlier, and there's different economic reforms in the reform tracking matrix, that 23 are progressing well. Can you give us a couple of examples of the, just a couple of examples of the reforms that are going places?
Yeah, some of the reform I mentioned about are some of the reform in the financial service sector, and also the provincial government, given we all know about how over-leveraged China at the moment is, and also a lot of it is really through kind of a back channel borrowing shadow banks. So at the moment, the China reform is a fiscal system. So for the first time, the provincial government can actually issue its own bond. Sorry about this technical detail, but I think in my mind and in the mind of the people who work on China's economy, it is kind of important. And also another one is China's demographic dividends are drying up. There's actually household registration reform, given the eviction of the migrant workers from Beijing, maybe it's not going so well. But in the way that there's a push for the farmers actually to be given more rights in the cities, big cities, to help the process of urbanization. But certainly it's very difficult for big city like Beijing, Shanghai, and that's why it's not happening in the big cities, but in the second, third tier cities is actually happening much faster. So. And these are some areas I think are kind of going well, but mostly around the state-owned enterprises areas and a lot of the taxation areas is just really very difficult. And if you think about all the low-hanging fruits of the reforms have already been picked. So now it's kind of a really difficult area. And also I think not just domestically, but internationally, some big events also shaped the way the Chinese policy makers think about economic reform. And don't forget, the 2008 global financial crisis, even though economically China, you know, through its massive stimulus package, the kind of almost like a perfect Keynesian experiment, did help China to get over the crisis, but in a way left a deep impression about the free market model. I mean, it's quite instructive that at a time, the Wang Qishan, the vice premier in charge of the economy, asked Hank Paulson that, were China think United States is the great teacher, but, you know, now my teacher's in trouble. You know, what can I learn from it? So that's why you say the whole idea of a state capitalism is back in fashion, in the way that because, you know, people ask the question, if US had such a spectacular implosion in the financial system, shouldn't we think about maybe the Chinese model works better? So that, I think that really slowed down the kind of a pace of what we would think would be liberalization and reform. I think that's also quite a formative event in the kind of history of China's economic reform.
So we're going to open up to questions in a minute or two, but before we do, I just wanted to get then a sense of the implications of this Xi Jinping's new era, these changes. Why are they important? And what do they mean not only for China, but certainly that's the first part of it. What do they mean for China? But what do they then mean for how China deals with the world? And Anne-Marie, if I could start with you.
Add on to what Peter was saying just a minute ago, you talked about the China model, the Zhongguo Moshi in Chinese. And so there's one change, I think, is the level of confidence coming from China. And the government wants to make the Chinese people confident too. And Xi has really been returning to the rhetoric of the founding ideas of the Chinese Communist Party to remind people, why do we have a Communist Party? Why do we need a Communist Party today? And so that's another really, I think that's a really profound difference, is this really the great confidence from coming from the government as a result of a feeling of success of its policies, even though there's huge difficulties and things they're not dealing with economically, as we can see from the outside. And the government also has really, I mean, the China dream is all about promoting confidence and talking up the market, is what I've called it in some of my research. So, but that's really resonating with the population too, because confidence is sometimes, I mean, it's what you, whether it's not necessarily about reality, it's what you're feeling. And so that's, you know, one of my areas of research for a number of years has been on China's modernized propaganda system. And propaganda is not a bad word in Chinese, by the way. It's just a term, a task of the government. So I'm literally translating, Xuanchuan. And keeping the confidence in the spirits of the Chinese people is absolutely essential in this system. And, you know, she really knows that. She has been a political cadre for a really long time. He's got a lot of political cadres in his Politburo. So the messaging is really important. And it has been since 1989. That's something that hasn't changed, that the party has understood that control over propaganda and ideology is absolutely essential, hand in hand with economic growth and development. And even when there are economic difficulties, then the two things have to work together. So the job of propaganda and thought workers to talk up the market and instill confidence. But we're really seeing a very confident Xi Jinping. But also, I thought in 2012, we saw a very confident Hu Jintao as well. I think this story often gets missed when people are commentating, talking about China, the level of confidence that the government has, and that the confidence that people in China have, accept and feeling optimistic about their future. I think that really is there. But to answer your question about the particular policies that are important, I think the maritime strategy is very important. I say that because I'm here in Australia with a 42% claim in Antarctica, and China's polar policies are part of the maritime bureaucracy, or the Haiyang Xitong. And China, as the maritime policies have become more important under Xi Jinping, so too have the polar issues. So I wanted to show a slide of this map, but I can only, due to technical problems in this room or restrictions in this room, I can only show you this picture. This is a vertical map of China. It's since 2014. Official map of China. And we're used to seeing the map of the world either Pacific-centred, usually Australia and New Zealand, and we're used to seeing a Pacific-centred map, or over in North America and Europe, they're used to seeing an Atlantic-centred map. And this map is a completely different vision, and it's part of this reorientation and a really bold global vision that China has. And she was articulating that boldness and that vision at the 19th Party Congress, as I said. And in this vision of the world, you see China, literally, Zhongguo, the Middle Kingdom, right here at the heart of this new geopolitical order. You see the prominence of Antarctica and the Arctic, Antarctica appearing like a white peacock. You see the world island, for those who are the geopolitics, political specialists in the room, Mackinder talked about the world island. You see how we are all interconnected by the oceans. And you could look at this map and from two angles. You could see how China is at the heart of this, and you could see those lines, and some of them are imaginary lines of the Belt Road Initiative, which all lead back to China. Or you could be the optimist and see us as a very interconnected world, and that the oceans connect us all, and it's going to be very cooperative. I leave it to your interpretation. But this is really, the maritime stuff is very, very important policy to the Xi government. And it's part of China's rise as a global great power, absolutely part of it. It's part of their investment in a blue water navy. It's part of their expansion into these new strategic territories, such as the Arctic and Antarctic, the deep seabed, cyberspace, outer space. All these areas have undetermined sovereignty, from China's perspective at least, despite the 42% claim of Australia and Antarctica, 15% for New Zealand, and various other percentages for Britain, France, Argentina, and Chile, Norway. But China doesn't recognise those claims in Antarctica, and the Antarctic Treaty allows them not to recognise it. So China is acting like rising great powers that we've seen in past history. And I often think about the United States in the 1890s and into World War I, where the US wasn't willing to take on we don't want to take on a leadership role. And Mahan is the strategist who really helped to shape US foreign policy at that time, and he talked about, in 1895, he wrote a very important book that talked about what a rising power needs to do, looking at the example of Britain and France and their rivalry. And so he said that a rising power needs to have control over its sea lanes of communication, that it needs to have a blue water navy to protect them, and it needs to have access to resources, whether through colonies or privileged relationships. So Mahan is the leading theorist of China's maritime strategy, and I think that that tells us a lot about China's global ambitions. The 90th Party Congress, these policies were addressed and highlighted, and the Congress is significant because it sort of fronts up to things that have been already discussed and debated, you know, for years in advance. So that's one area that I would highlight. And another big change this year is China's promoting its own version of democracy. Now, that's a really big change, because going back to the China model, China wasn't so actively promoting that. Countries wanted to learn from it. They said, yeah, sure, we'll share it. We can help you with trying to control your media, for example, if you're interested in that. But this year, there have been a number of public statements contesting the idea or the interpretation of democracy. And I think we're going to see more of that. And then China's political influence activities, that's another significant change. And that was mentioned in the Congress, but the changes and the ramping up of that strategy have been going on for a couple of years now. Thank you.
Peter, I do want to save some time for our audience to get in, so if you wouldn't mind keeping your reflections on this a little bit brief.
Oh, I'll keep it really short. Thanks for bringing up the topic, my favourite topic of the Belt and Road. Thanks, that's a very nice segue. If you haven't read my report, please do. It's on the website. I just think, in terms of Belt and Road, it's really kind of interesting. It is a really interesting strategy. It is probably, in terms of its importance, probably is one of the foremost important economic and foreign policy initiative under President Xi. It has multiple dimensions. You can talk about many aspects of the Belt and Road. Just a little bit around the economic side, it's very clear that the ideas about the connectivities, about building all those connectivities of all the countries, especially in China's neighborhood, and a connect back to Beijing, it's just not infrastructure building. It's about building industrial parks, the migration of lower-end manufacturing to countries, and have a China set up as a center for kind of almost like a regional global production hub, with China moving increasingly to higher-end manufacturing, more advanced manufacturing, be it high-speed rail, nuclear reactors, you name it. So it has that kind of very strong kind of economic dimension to it. I think it's quite important. I think I'll probably just leave it there.
Okay. Peter. All right. Dear audience, the microphone will be coming around. If you want to ask a question, if you could wait for the microphone and also just give us your name and your affiliation, please.
Richard Muse. I guess the longest frontier of China is with Russia, or at least the former Soviet Union, bits and pieces left over. As you say, the concentration has been on the People's Liberation Navy, but Russia is a declining power. China, as you've explained, is definitely the expanding power. What will be the long-term game there? At the moment, they appear to agree, but long-term, it's perhaps a bit harder to say.
Anne-Marie?
Russia and China are partnering in many areas, including military. And it was very interesting to me to observe in September 2014 when the Chinese Navy was in naval exercises with the Russian Navy, and for the first time the Chinese Navy made a very unlikely detour. Instead of going home from Vladivostok, went up to the Aleutians and did a freedom of navigation exercise into a little bit of the Arctic and then down again as a signal to the United States that, you know, we can do this, and we can do it in your neighborhood too. And so from in China, and but when it comes to Arctic issues, Russia is interested in Chinese investment in oil and gas and in infrastructure, but is also wary of some other aspects of China's interest. For example, what's China's position on the Arctic Sea Route? China would like it to be understood as an international shipping route. Russia doesn't want that. So it won't. It's not a perfect partnership, but they do. They are working together in many areas.
I can be shameless again, doing a bit of a promotion. Read Law Institute's a really good book by Dr. Bobo Law. He actually just published a book on China-Russia relationship. It's $9.99. You can finish in one session. So that book will answer your question.
I was going to do that, but thank you for making me look like a better person. Now we had a question up in the back corner, please. If you could just wait for the mic and name it.
Robin Fitzsimons. I apologise if I was late and if this has been answered, but the Port of Darwin, do you have any comments about that in terms of overall Chinese strategy? And we were all assured that we should not be worried about it. Do you agree?
Anne-Marie, do you want to go first again on that?
I actually like to hear your response, Meriden.
Peter?
Thank you. Should I start quitting the ex-Secretary of Defence, Dennis Richardson, to give you the... He thinks it's fine at a time that definitely caused a lot of discussion or division or debate internally in Australia about whether that particular port or leasing of it, to be more accurate, is actually the right decision. There's one school of thinking says at a time the agencies were not really actively involved. Therefore, was a bad decision. With the benefit of the hindsight now, maybe the different decision will be made, but that's not what Dennis Richardson said publicly. But in the case of the port, I mean, what makes me really wonder about that particular case is actually, there was an article in the Financial Review, they actually said the Landbridge, the group actually bought, or leased the port, actually borrowed quite heavily, at a quite heavy interest rate to finance the deal. In terms of a commercial decision, probably not a very sound one. Let's see how that one pan out. But from my end, looking at the decision, I think it's if someone is willing to put hundreds of million dollars into a port and good luck to them. So if they can make it work, I think that's just once again, I put on my economic business hat on. I think if they want to risk their investment, just like all mining investment, by the way, if you remember the mining investment into Australia, CITIC, they really regret now that they jumped into bed with Clive Palmer and just blew a bit about $10 billion now in desert of Western Australia. So that's kind of my, long-standing philosophy. If you want to waste your money, go ahead.
I don't have much to add. It went through all the processes that we had in place, and the decision was reviewed by the decision-making bodies that existed. But I think you could possibly be a bit cynical and a bit sceptical about being willing to throw that much money at something that isn't going to have necessarily an immediate commercial return. I mean, that might have some questions around it. Question down the front, please.
Hi, David Chin from Basis Point. Could the panel please comment about what you think of China's reaction to Australia's white paper, foreign white paper, and also what you think China's reaction is to the recent moves to change the laws about international espionage, etc., and interfering in the Australian political process?
Well, I'll comment on the aspect of the white paper that I pay most attention to, and that was the wording on Antarctica and the Southern Ocean. And that was pretty strongly asserting Australian sovereignty, and which is entitled to do so under the Antarctic Treaty, but sovereign rights, which is more debatable, whether it's from Australia's position, it can assert those sovereign rights, and from China and other states' point of view, no, it can't. And that's because there's a little bit of a disconnect between the United Nations Law of the Sea and the Antarctic Treaty. So my observation is, when I saw that part of the report, is that I think some of the Antarctic players are going to be irked by that wording, and indeed China was irked by that wording. At least we publicly know China, we know that China was publicly, I don't know what other states like Russia or China might have thought, US might have thought about it. So on China's response to the new law that's been going to be passed in Australia, well, of course, you could expect a public response from China that's totally predictable. But China has similarly very strict laws on exactly the same issue. So it's a bit like the pot calling the kettle black, as we say in New Zealand. Any country wants to protect its political system from international interference. That's completely normal. Any country wants to defend itself against espionage. So if a given government feels that there are weaknesses in the political system, it's quite understandable if they want to straighten up and improve things. And I don't think China would be any different in that respect.
Perhaps I haven't followed the foreign policy white paper debate very closely. From what I have seen, it seems to be a more muted response, at least by the foreign ministry spokesperson in Beijing. It seems to be the big issue was really around Australia's position around the South China Sea, which is nothing new, really. If anything, I mean, what I find really interesting in the paper, the way I read it is actually for the first time publicly, we actually expressed some concern about the reliability of US as an alliance partner. I mean, that's my read. Maybe I'm completely wrong here. So I thought that's kind of the Prime Minister in the opening statement actually mentioned about being a more sovereign and independent country. I thought that's actually rather, I don't know, positive message that to be received in China. Maybe I just don't really, I haven't picked up much kind of reaction in China. I think another thing is always, what I find interesting is, allow me to quote Shakespeare in a way, there's a bit of unrequited love between China and Australia, not in terms of a trust and affection, but just in terms of attention, right? It's, we're obsessed with China, let's admit it. Like, front page, story day in, day out, TV, radio, you switch on, we can't stop talking about China. There's just not a similar level for obsession in China. And so sometime when we talk about what is China's reaction, maybe one or two people bother to comment on a topic, comment on it, and then we pick up, magnified, and regard as a hot topic of a debate in China. Maybe that's not the case. I mean, sometime I just think it's important we put into it a bit of perspective. Well, though we think it's a huge issue here, I don't know whether they actually register that much in Beijing. Sorry, it just might
that
really.
Really hurts,
that's
yeah.
my really.
That really hurts.
That's my really. Because I used to work as a journalist, we love to exaggerate headlines, anyway, at least. Sorry.
Thank you. There was a question. I'm sorry, there was this question here first, please.
My colleague prepared the question. I passed the mic.
Thank you.
Oh, sorry. We just want to ask about the after.
Sorry, can
the,
we just get your name and your affiliation, please?
I'm Nina, and we're from Epoch Times.
Thank you.
We're just wondering about the North Korea issue, because wondering if that's possible. America and China, they can ally on this to, military attack. Is that possible? What's the expert's opinion on this? And what do you think Australians stance if that happened?
Okay, thanks.
North Korea is a real headache for China. It has been for a long time. And the internal materials that I've read about it are that China feels that it's really has much less options than the US does to deal with it, with the problem in North Korea. And will have more, for the US, it's very far away, North Korea. It's right on Chinese border. Even if there wasn't an outbreak of war, if the nuclear experiment, shuttle launch goes wrong, a test launch goes wrong, then you know China will be affected, or any other kind of nuclear incident. China gets the blame for not taking action on North Korea. But they have a treaty of mutual defense, and North Korea is like a buffer state for China. So a united Korea could be pro-China, or it could be pro-US. It would depend on the global environment and how things were in China. So North Korea is a really big headache for China, not really easy for China to resolve at all. And as to predict the war or not, I don't know. I've been observing and teaching on North Korean politics now for about 16, 17 years. And I've just seen crisis after crisis on North Korea and Taiwan too. And I think it's too much exaggeration in the headlines, actually, so that I have ceased to get alarmed. I may be under-alarmed, maybe from having watched it too long, that I'm under-alarmed. My sense is that the crisis will pass, and we've seen this before. Unfortunately, it's been dragging out for a really long time. Did you want anything?
So I'm no North Korean or expert, but I find it really interesting is just reading about some of the commentary in China. I don't think at a popular level there's much love for North Korean system. When people do go to North Korea, it's almost like going back in time, a blast from past, to say what life was like during the Cultural Revolution. I just think it's at a popular level, there's in China, and North Korea is like just like anywhere else, not a particularly popular country. That's my only observation.
Thanks. I think we have time for just one more question. The lady at the back here, please.
Thank you, Carol Austin. Could you talk a bit about how China sees involvement in foreign countries' politics? All countries have spies, that's normal, but what we're seeing is something quite different in the way in which China's approaching its relations with foreign countries. More broad-based, seeing students and the diaspora as part of their role is to promote the interests of China. So could you talk about conceptually how we should think about China as opposed to the United States and other countries that clearly use their agencies to support the interests of the home country?
I agree with you. Particularly great powers do use their various official agencies and intermediaries to try and influence other countries. You know, as a small citizen of a small state, New Zealand has seen that, and we've had a dependency on the UK, and we're a colony of the UK, and then we've been in a military partnership with the United States, and we passed legislation in 1987, that the anti-nuclear legislation that the US was very critical of, and has pressured New Zealand historically about that. However, what China is doing in New Zealand and Australia and other countries is on a completely different scale. And it has in part to do with the political system in China, because China's a party state, and so, and particularly in this era, we're seeing the party's role is being highlighted and giving more authority than it has for a very, very long time. After 1949, when the People's Republic of China was formed, the party and the state were supposed to be separated formally. So this re-merging is a really interesting trend, and where it connects into what you've asked about is about the role of what's called the United Front Department. And so the United Front Department is one aspect of the foreign policy tools of the CCP. So it's separate. When we think of this as interfuse, the party state, because we can't say it's completely separate from the Ministry of Foreign Affairs in China, because there will be, diplomats in China would be party members too, so they're under party discipline. and there will be people who are in Chinese embassies who are tasked with United Front activities. But there is some, you know, different levels at which the Chinese Party State operates. So I'm separating trade and business on the whole from these activities. So the role of the United Front Department when it comes to China's foreign policy, and particularly under Xi Jinping, where it's been really elevated and given much more prominence, is to shape global public opinion about China. China feels itself suffering from very negative and hostile public opinion internationally, and that has an impact on China's policies, its strategies. For example, the maritime and the polar strategies. If people in the Arctic don't want China to be active in the Arctic, then that will affect the way that their governments respond to China's interests in the Arctic. So public opinion really matters to China. And China is seeking, as I said, as part of that Mahanian maritime strategy, privilege access to resources. So it requires market information and relationships and knowledge that can be got through these kind of front activities, because there it's about using economic and political links, offering incentives, financial or otherwise, to those who are going to work with agents of the Chinese Communist Party, to the Chinese community, there's a big effort to influence them as part of the strategy. And some of this is not about foreign policy when it comes to the Chinese communities in Australia and New Zealand and the US or Canada. This is also about China's domestic needs, because under Xi Jinping, the message is really important, as I said, managing the information environment. So because of the internet and the freedom of movement that Chinese people have now, it's not enough for the information environment, the public sphere in China, to be sealed off. They can't achieve that. Even North Korea can't achieve that. And so it matters what is said about China in Chinese language materials in Australia and New Zealand and Canada and so on. Hence the attempt to fuhe, to harmonise or merge the message, that the editorial of those kind of newspapers, websites, television stations, radio stations, with the message in mainland China. And beyond that is also an attempt now, to which we've seen this year, to put pressure on those who are promoting, publishing information about China. For example, we've seen Cambridge University Press, Springer, and a number of other academic presses, who we now know have been asked to censor what they were sending into China. The academic publications have been written about China, again, because what is said about China in the academic world can filter into China and undermine the party's message. So there's two levels to this. Both is this foreign policy agenda, a much more assertive foreign policy agenda that can be promoted through the organisations and the agents associated with United Front work. And then is that domestic need, which is aimed at maintaining stability in China, which is all having a negative effect on our democracy by the way in which it's affecting freedom of association, freedom of speech in our Chinese communities and our societies, and in the way it's affecting and silencing debates in our China expert communities in Australia, New Zealand, the United States, and so on, as universities and university presses and other publishing outlets and think tanks feel that they have to follow a friendly line towards China. I'll just give one little example, additional example to that, was the Hudson Institute, which backed down on inviting Guo Wengui, who's a whistleblower on the Chinese government, very important figure in the Chinese community. The Hudson Institute, which is a very much a right-wing think tank, they backed down under massive pressure from Chinese authorities not to host this guy. So it's just one example of the ripple effect. Thank you.
We are going to wrap things up now, and I just wanted to invite a word from our sponsors. I'd like to invite the Managing Director of the North Asia Program, Mr. Beng Neo, to just say a couple of words to wrap things up. Thanks.
Thank you, Meriden. Thank you very much, and it has been very insightful and thought-provoking session for us. I mean, for AMP, we've been in China for quite a while, and we have a strategic partnership with China Life for over a decade. And for us, it's really focused in terms of how we tap into the ongoing economic reforms and the market opportunities there. And it's great to hear about in terms of and if you sort of witness the sort of massive transformation that's been taking place over the past couple of decades, especially as Peter mentioned, post WTO and more recently post the global financial crisis, looking at the quite substantial restructuring of the industries in China, from an export oriented to a more domestic consumption focus. And great to hear from Anne-Marie in terms of the people in China. And there's great insights in terms of hearing about people, how you see the people in Shanghai and across the country as well. And I think it is such a massive country. I mean, it's 1.38 billion people, and I think to hear about in terms of the realistic nature, and I think important the confidence and the optimism, because we want to see more opportunities coming out from China in over time. Now, of course, thank you to Lowy Institute for hosting this event, and if we could put our hands together for Emery and Pira. Thank you very much. Thank you.